Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our last Building Leadership of the Year. The title for tonight's presentation is The Kindness Revolution, Why Choose It? And we have Maura Cassidy with us again, once more, helping us kind of get more information on this topic. Thank you, Maura. Take it away.
Super. Delighted to be here again, and I hope that some of the ideas here this evening might just spark off a few thoughts that I'm sure you have already yourselves. There's some good bibliography on this. First and foremost, some of the great resources Maria has been using with the different year groups, which are really appropriate for teens, and some really nice TED Talks and clips in the midst of it all. I love this title because it is about a revolution of kindness. And the beautiful thing about kindness at the outset to say is that we can always choose it. It doesn't matter how we feel about ourselves sometimes, you know, it can help us to get out of a you know, maybe a little moment of sort of not feeling the Mae West ourselves, as we'd say. So we can always choose to leave somebody in a better way than they were before. And I'm sure we've all got lovely examples of that in our lives, or maybe we've been at the receiving end or we've been at the giving end of it. And there's something tremendously beautiful about an act of kindness, because it's responding to the humanity of the person right in front of us, whether that person is in a queue, whether that person's at a till, whether that person's a work colleague or a family member. They're all unique human beings, and we all have the same need to give and to receive kindness. And so in tonight's talk, I just thought we'd look at the importance and the value of kindness, and the need each of us has to give and to receive it. The challenges of our teens in being kind, which you're probably familiar with, but it's no harm to remind ourselves, because their interactions are very much framed by social media, most of their interactions. And it's how we can help them to understand themselves better and step away from their devices so that they can indeed engage with face-to-face dialogue and appreciation of others and acts of kindness. Because as we all know from the pandemic, that's what we sorely missed during that time, was the real contact with people. And then just various tools I'll interject throughout the way of trying to help our teens to step away for them from what can be very emotive conflict, you know, emotional conflict, and instead to give themselves an opportunity to gain perspective, to talk, to dialogue, and to decide on how they're going to respond to any given situation. So I suppose first thing really is to look at why kindness. I suppose I like to think about it, and Maria has brought it out very nicely in the various different resources. You can think about kindness in lots of ways, but I think the way she frames it is very nice. It's, first of all, common kindness, which is politeness. You know, it's how we engage with people, just in a polite manner, a nice way, sort of a courtesy. And then the second, you might say, way of framing kindness, type of kindness, is confetti kindness, which is like that special moment, those things that we do for each other, those celebratory moments, the extraordinaries and things like that. And the third type of kindness is rather deep kindness. And deep kindness has a lot to do with how we engage with the very person who's in front of us. So it has to do with the fact that we step out of our own comfort zone and try to see reality from that other person. It's really about empathy. It's really about that desire to serve that other person. And that's actually probably one of the most fulfilling things that we can do. It's one of the most enriching things that we can do, is to let go of ourselves so that we can take the risk and be there for another person. It's not something that our teens are familiar with, is taking the risk with friendships, because it feels very vulnerable. It feels very insecure. But at the same time, vulnerability, as we know, is a very important, you might say, quality of any relationship. Vulnerability is another way of saying openness. Vulnerability is another way of saying leaving ourselves free to be hurt if that were to happen. And I think as parents yourselves, is the challenge can be sometimes to want to fix things, you know. Beautifully, I think, drawn out in some of the resources is the difference between sympathy and empathy. When we sympathize with somebody, we're you might say, silver lining their experience. You know, if a teen was to say to a friend, "Oh, I'm not allowed to go out tonight," or "My parents won't let me do this," the silver lining it is, you know, "Oh, Oh, well, at least your parents care. At least your parents. It's not to deal with the person, and it's not to deal with the situation at that moment where that person's having an emotional reaction. They're upset, they're tired, they're angry, they're disconcerted. Whatever the situation is, we need to sit with that person in that emotion at that time and feel it with them and say, "Look, I'm really sorry you're feeling," and mirror it to them so they feel that sense of presence, that sense of company, that sense of kindness in that moment. And then when that person is ready to step out of that, step away from that, you might say that emotive reaction, then it's the point at which the empathy comes in, the deep friendship comes in, and we can try to walk with them to regain perspective or to see what the next step is. And that's, I suppose, the challenge sometimes as parents or as caring adults. When we see the teens suffering, we want to take away that suffering. But before we do that, and to be honest, our job is not to take away the suffering, because the suffering is part of the growing, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But anyway, I just wanted to, I suppose, whenever we talk to Gen Z, it's always very important to say why, not just what, which I've just shared with you, what types of kindness there are, but why. And I think, and what a lot of the why has to do with what does it look like? How do our teens learn what kindness looks like? Well, it's role models from adults that they know, from us, first and foremost. So that puts the challenge on us, is do we reflect kindness first in our interactions with your other half, maybe with siblings, with work colleagues, whatever it is, with people we find challenging, people we find easy, situations that set us back. How do we deal with them? How do we care for those people? How do we talk about them when they're not present? What are our interactions like? And I'm sure you've heard that lovely story. Well, it was a study actually done by psychologists on hospital janitors in a hospital in the US. And the job description of a hospital janitor contains many things you'd expect, like mopping the floor, sweeping the floor, emptying the bins, restocking cabinets, all of that kind of thing. It's done at generally times unsociable times. But it and th those jobs aren't that surprising. And it's a pretty long list. But the one thing that a janitor's job spec doesn't include is human beings, their interactions with human beings, which other medical staff would include, like nurses or doctors. And yet, when the psychologist interviewed many of these janitors and to get a sense of what they thought their job was like, they met people like Mike, who told them how he stopped mopping the floor when a particular patient was out of his bed getting a little exercise. He was trying to build up his strength and he's walking along the corridors. And this particular janitor, Mike, said, "No, I'm not going to mop the floor right now because he needs to do his exercise. That's the space that he's in, and I'm here to serve him." Or Charlene, another janitor, who was her supervisor gave her feedback apparently one point to, to ask her to Hoover to make sure the hoovering was done well in the lounge, the public area. And she noticed that one of the patient's family members was there. They'd been there all night and they were asleep in the lounge, the public lounge. And she thought, "I'm not going to actually wake them up now when they've got that little nap that they have been able to take, probably after just being beside the bedside of a loved one, and I'll do it later." Or another janitor, Luke, who basically washed the bedroom floor of a patient who was in a coma because the man's father hadn't seen him wash it the first time, was upset, felt that he wasn't taking care of his son. And so Luke decided to give him peace of mind that his son was getting the best attention. He could, instead of saying, "Well, no, I did actually wash it and you need to believe me," he just did it again because he felt this man at this particular moment needed peace of mind about his son's health. And so what they actually found, these particular, I suppose, psychologists found that not only were the janitors themselves very conscious of the human impact of their work, but also that their behavior, it didn't just make people feel a little bit better in the moment, but it actually improved the quality of patient care and had a huge significant impact on the running of the hospital as well. Now, not all janitors are like that, obviously. But what's beautiful is to see in these particular individuals is that they saw human interactions which weren't obvious, and they saw the kindness, the empathy, which were an essential part of why they did their job. And yet their job description, as we know, contained not one word about human beings. So you might say they had a moral compass to be kind. And they also had the moral skill to realize what kindness looked like for different people. It wasn't just about fulfilling their jobs or, you know, mopping the floor or hoovering the floor when suited them or when they needed to do it, when their supervisor needed to do it. The person at the center of this was the people, those patients and those families of those patients in the hospital. So I don't know about you, but I'm always very inspired by that story. And our teams need to be inspired to be kind. They need to see, you might say, incarnated examples of kindness around them, because kindness is a choice. You know, 2000 years ago, the Greek philosopher Aristotle said, we learn by doing. We become builders by building, lyre players by playing the lyre. So too, we become good by doing good acts, and brave by doing brave acts, kind by doing kind acts. That's 2000 years ago. When we do kindness, we become kind. We have a kind character. David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, in his book Road to Character, says, he reminds us of this truth as well. He says, it doesn't matter if you're working on Wall Street or in a charity distributing medicine to the poor, the road to character is built along a path, which is interesting, of moral crisis, confrontation, and recovery. So there's no such thing, you might say, of, you know, sort of easy kindness. You know, we can all be kind, as you mentioned at the beginning, and polite and show courtesy to people we like, or in moments where there's no commitment, or we can also be kind to people that we just enjoy and we don't find any challenge in it. But when there's a little crisis, when I don't feel kind, particularly kind, when somebody isn't being particularly kind as far as I see it to me, or when I'm confronted with a situation that I find very challenging, or when I let somebody else down myself and I feel like walking away. Those are the moments of recovery, and that's precisely where the growth in that beautiful strength of kindness takes place. In other words, none of our teens will pick up kindness like they pick up their phone. We need to suffer its absence to experience its importance. We need to confront ourselves, our true selves, and that's what we do as caring adults, is try to accompany our teens in that journey. And because it is a journey, and when the going gets tough, that's the point at which the growth will take place. So they'll experience maybe what they see as a lack of kindness in somebody, a friend or a fellow student, and that'll become a catalyst for them reflecting on the virtue, you know, reflecting on what it means to them, reflecting on when they experience lack of kindness themselves or others, how do they ensure that it's a core value in the way they live? So we're trying to help our teens to be kind, not just when they feel like it, or not just when others are kind to us. Because there's no commitment or maturing or growth in that response. It's a little bit like 4-year-olds, you know, I'll do this because mommy says I'm good and I'll get a lollipop, you know, as adults. And as I always say to the girls, you know, you're growing into young adulthood. And these are the things that need to take root. We often hear that loving our enemies as ourselves. And one of the books that I really recommend is called Loving Your Enemies, written by the Arthur Brooks, who some of you may be familiar with. He's in Stanford. He's in a think tank now, and he's almost called the happiness guru. He's written another book recently called From Strength to Strength. Both of them are bestsellers. But he talks about kindness as a quality of a true leader. And a true leader has that moral compass. So they don't just do tolerate. They don't just tolerate people they find challenging. They reach out to them. They don't play it safe. You know, just stay away from challenge. And neither do they live on the premise of just trying not to offend. And he goes on to say that the true beauty of our relationships is found in the trust of give and take, hurt and forgiveness, and beginning again. So true freedom is not just about a choice. You have a choice to do this or not to that, to do that. It's the freedom to be free from our weak points, you might say, to grow. And in those strengths, and to commit to our life projects, which are often beyond ourselves. So, how do we help our teens to taste what kindness looks like? How do we help our teens to pivot or change an initial emotional reaction and not to give in to a learned behavior, but to respond as they know what's true and right and best? Oliver Berkman, in his book 4,000 Weeks, talks about meaning. And he says basically that we're all in search for meaning, in search of meaning in our lives. There's nothing new in that statement, because meaning gives us purpose. It gives a sense of value. But he tells us how he gives us a guess, a question rather. How do we know it when we have meaning in our lives? And he says, well, we know when we have meaning in our lives when we are willing to suffer for something. So you might say, as caring adults, what we're trying to do with our teens is help them to choose the right sufferings. You know, so if our teens can't suffer for something that's important and meaningful, they will never encounter happiness. And it's our job to show them how to value suffering for the right things. Marion Rojas, who's another, she's another bestseller, and her book has come out, How to Make Good Things Happen, tells us that, I think this is very insightful, that why do we find it harder, or do our teens find this harder? Well, we live in an age where of extraordinary opportunity, which is at our fingertips. It's so accessible. This is in the Western world, obviously. Unlike previous generations, who had to really suffer and strive to make it. But in our world, opportunity, in comparison to previous generations who had to suffer for it, it doesn't take as much effort to avail of. And inadvertently, she points out, that does increase a sense of entitlement. There's a sense that among our teens sometimes that everything in life should come easy to us, or easier, or, you know, shouldn't be so challenging. And if things are challenging, then there's something wrong with us. There's something, you know, wrong, or there's something wrong with the thing that's challenging me, and I need to step away. And I think that's so much of that we see in our teens when they did get disconcerted with problems, you know, normal problems, when they get confused by interactions, you know, when they get stressed because things require effort or don't work out first time or as they hoped, as they wanted to. They're always comparing, you know, social media and thinking this is not the way it should be. There's a lot of should in their life. Whereas our job as adults is to normalize effort for our teens. Because again, effort is a sign of growth. Effort is what embeds things. Effort is really a sign that we care for something. We put effort into it, which means we try, we fail, we try again, we fail. Sometimes we ask for forgiveness. Some of you may be familiar. I like reading the lives of the saints, and it's a lovely thing in the Catholic tradition, because obviously all our heroes in the Catholic tradition are people who strived and failed and become saints. But tomorrow is a feast day of a blessed Alvaro, and he actually visited Rosemont in its previous iteration. But he had a lovely phrase he used to use in his life, which was, "Thank you, sorry, help me more." And it's something that Pope Francis quoted in his beatification ceremony, which is the first step or major step in the canonization of somebody when they're recognized as a saint by the Catholic Church. And I found that phrase very helpful. Thank you, sorry, help me more. It's just enabling us to embrace our humanity. We're not meant to get things right straight off. And how we learn is by failing. So when we're grateful for things, grateful for the right things, we tend to root ourselves in the right things, not in successes, but in growing and reaching out to others. So I suppose that's just, I suppose, an introduction in terms of our role as caring adults. Kindness is, like all other, you might say, leadership qualities or virtues, it's a combination of will and skill. I think that's helpful. A kind person knows when and how to make exceptions. So just as the janitors knew when to ignore the job duties, which were in the service of others, they knew when to pivot. They knew when to improvise, you know, they knew when to wash the floor, when not to wash the floor, when to hoover, when to not. And I think somebody who's wise in living a virtue, so wise in kindness, is a bit like a jazz musician. They use the notes on the page, but they can dance around them. They can invent combinations that are appropriate for the person at hand. It's where the empathy comes in. It's where we know when somebody reacts in a particular way, it doesn't always mean they're reacting to us. It means that something's wrong, they're upset, something's taken away their peace, something's challenging them. And I suppose that's where the moment of kindness comes in and empathy comes in. So to serve other people and I think it's a beautiful thing for our teens to realize that kind people are not born, they're made. And we make ourselves. We have the opportunity every day to choose to be kind. We have the opportunity every day to start a new page. If we've been unkind previously the other day, or distracted, or disconcerted, or inconsiderate, we can begin again. And it's all about experience, you know. We need to have permission to improvise, to try new things, to occasionally fail. And I know I've said this many times before in the building leadership, but sometimes I do find our teens carry burdens which are not theirs to carry. We're not like a silver coin that everybody's going to like us all of the time. Some of the things that we do upset others. We can say things that we don't mean to upset people, but we've caught somebody off guard on a bad day and they overreact or they react. And we blame ourselves for that. And that's why I think it's very important for us as adults, once we've sat with our teens in the emotional space, is then to sit with them and go, okay, well, let's just walk through that here. Don't think that's your fault here. I think you need to give a bit of space for this. Just a small thing. I know it seems totally irrelevant maybe in the moment, but reading novels is such a good way of doing this, because our teens, when they read novels tend to walk through human experience. And the classics are fantastic. Some of Dickens novels, like David Copperfield, like there's hilarity, there's crazy, there's drama, but there is also quite a bit of suffering there. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to read through it and sit with another character as they suffer. And because it reminds us that, no pain, no gain. We don't get the other side of pain others until we've actually walked through it. So helping our teens to reflect on that and to absorb it. And also helping them to reflect on the fact that when somebody is kind to them, how do they feel? They feel human, they feel loved, they feel respected, they feel like giving back, much like many of those patients in the hospital case of the janitors. I would suggest there can be certain unwritten rules in every household, and I'm sure many of you have them already, but interactions at home, that above all, we strive that they're respectful and kind. And that we hold ourselves accountable. Oh, that wasn't very nice, or that doesn't sound like your better self, or I don't think you really meant that. So we just give somebody a second opportunity to clarify. Ideas are not the person, and that's a challenge in our world. That so often, if you disagree with somebody, we personalize it. We can disagree with someone in their opinions or ideas, but we can still be great friends. We can be still very close to them. We don't associate the idea with the person. They're entitled to think what they think, and they can still be wonderfully great people. Why in our society is that happening, that things get very emotive or overreactive sometimes? Because being online dehumanizes situations. Just need to be on Twitter for a while. There's more hate online than in person. There's more unkindness online than in person. And that's why, as part of the kindness virtue with the girls, we walk through with them how to be kind on social media. And it has a lot to do with helping them to step into the reflective space. Think before you say it. Think before you post it. Reflect on how that other person will pick it up, etc. So face-to-face leads to respect. Whereas when we post things on social media, the person isn't in front of us. We're just sitting with their own emotional reaction. So helping our teens to wire their brain to the use it or lose it premise, that we're all the time trying to help them to create space between the stimulus sometimes of somebody's sadness or our own bad reaction or somebody being unkind to us, trying to create a space between that stimulus and our response. How do I respond to somebody else's pain? How do I notice somebody else's pain, reflecting on that? Or how do I react to what I would see as unkindness? If somebody says or posts something they find upsetting, or that you've posted that they found upsetting, not to get into a tit for tat with it, defensive mechanism. The old fashioned approach, your mother would have sent you to sit outside for 10 seconds to think, to give it your emotion a chance to settle. And now in the 21st century equivalent, we pop the 10-second rule is turn your phone off, put your phone away, and then create a space, sit with that, step away, breathe, give yourself a few moments. Because physiologically, when somebody, our teens have a moment to just be and just to breathe slowly, box breathing, whatever it is we do with them, physiologically, you can't feel stressed or overwhelmed when your body's at rest. Will Bowen, in his book, you might be familiar with it, it's called A Complaint-Free World. He recalls an incident in his own life where he didn't react with kindness. He overreacted. And I'm focusing on these examples because this is where sometimes what can happen to our teens is they find it hard to be kind because they sometimes say, well, so-and-so is not kind to me. It's easier to be kind to people we like or we get on with or we have ease with, or on people, random people we don't have much to do with. But it's harder sometimes to be kind when somebody else is a little bit harder to be kind to. But anyway, Will Bowen recalls this incident in his own life where his little daughter's dog was knocked and killed by hit and run. And of course, the whole family was in a huge heap, not no least his daughter and himself. And he could see the truck pulling away, that they were moving off. And he realized that the gentleman driving the truck had actually been responsible for the incident. So he chased and chased his car, broke the speed limit, so much so that he could feel the car lifting off the tarmac. And he could pretty much could feel road rage absorbing him. And when the truck came to a standstill and stopped outside a house, he stopped. He pursued the man up the driveway and he said, "Excuse me, sir, you just killed my daughter's dog." And the gentleman turned around and he said, "Yeah, and so what? Dead dog, nothing I can do about it," which of course is pretty shocking. And Will Bone just didn't know how to, you know, digest that. And he said, "I can't believe it. You've just, you know," and he said, "What are you going to do about it?" The gentleman said, "Are you going to hit me? Because if you do, that's assault and I can have you charged for that." So he just stepped back. And thankfully, as he said later, I got back into my car after, well, he did express a few expletives and a bit of anger, but he didn't assault him in any physical way. He left the gentleman's house, drove home completely deflated to a brokenhearted little daughter and family. And later that evening, he wanted to reflect on his own behavior. And because he was pretty shocked by his own reaction, understandable, but then that escalated. And he walked through and he thought, how would a man not empathize with the little girls, the death of little girls, little dog? How would a human being not empathize in knowing and not feel guilty or in some way responsible, knowing that he actually was the one who led to the death of that little dog? How could he not empathize with the father suffering? And he realized it said a lot more about the gentleman himself than it said about him as a father or his daughter. And he began to think that somebody can feel somebody else emotion and can't empathize with it in that situation. That man himself must be suffering so much more than I. And that's what we try to help the girls to realize, is the importance of empathy. It's because we can't feel it, just because we don't see it, the importance of stepping into somebody else's shoes instead of reacting. Why did that person react that way? What has happened in her day? Why is she feeling that? To step away if we're finding it hard, but don't jump to conclusions. And to remind our teens how they can feel sometimes when they've been judged. You know, sometimes when they've done something to a friend that could be interpreted as unkind or inconsiderate, and they realize they didn't mean to, but they were worried about a school test, or granny was sick last night, or whatever it is. They need that space to be able to explain themselves. Well, each of us need to be able to do that. And we need to try to help them to be the bigger person. You know, to ask the person, "Why did you do that? Tell me why." You know, affirm their dignity. "That's not like you. Let's talk about it." Empathy of stepping into somebody else's shoes. I was very struck by one of the videos that Maria uses by this gentleman called Houston, who's actually a teacher. And he talked about being on a long haul flight with the lady beside him who, let's put it this way, wasn't really feeling like talking to her. He was going a long flight. He was tired. And this lady was just very exuberant and wanted to talk for the full 4 hour flight. And he wasn't really feeling like it. But when this lady told him her story, he was so grateful. This lady told him that the last time she'd been on a flight, she was 2 hours waiting in an airport and 4 hours on a flight, going to be with her father on his deathbed. It seemed the medical team had rung her and said, "Come home as soon as you can." And she traveled those 3,000 kilometers and miles rather. She was sobbing in the airport. She was, you know, tearful at moments on the plane, but nobody came to her once to ask her, "Are you okay? Do you need anything?" And so she when this gentleman shared with her, he shared with her the thing they were doing in school, which was all about kindness. And he said, "That's one of the biggest motivating things I have in school, is teaching the teens the importance of reaching out to others, stepping into their vulnerability and yeah, just accompanying them in their pain and helping them to gain perspective on their pain." He just realized that this lady had never experienced that. Not one person in 3,000 kilometers in a situation which was quite extremely challenging objectively for her, the death of her father. So I think those examples are very helpful because we just don't know what that other person's experiencing. If someone's not handling themselves, you know, and it's a different situation, you know, or somebody's trying to undermine our teens, so we just try to help them to walk away, not to get into a spat or a tit for tat. There's a lovely example given in the book Getting to Yes, written by this man called Yuri. He's one of the co-authors, and he has been at these infamous Camp David Accords for the Israeli and Palestinian conflict. And he talked about the idea that we have peace talks, but we should have listening talks, and that listening should always come first. And we listen with our ears, we listen with our eyes, we observe, we take things in. And that's again where the importance of stimulus and response is. And he commented on the fact that no discussion should start with what we want to get out of it. You should always start with, why are you here? And that's also very helpful with our teens when we're trying to help them in situations where they don't feel like being kind, or where they have been unkind, or where we're trying to help them to be kind, to notice opportunities, is to ask them, you know, why would you be kind? Why is that person, you know, important to you? You know, why is that person's well-being important to you? And rather than what, you know, why did something upset you? Why do you value her friendship? Why do you think your friend reacted that way? Only then we can ask, well, what kind of person do you want to be? Be the change you want to see in others, and be the bigger person. How we treat people tells us a lot about how we think of them. And we can change the way we think and act, particularly in the area of kindness, because it's not a soft virtue. You know, sometimes people think of kindness as just the weak virtue, whereas it's a terribly strong one. It's a terribly human one. It's the one of not needing to be right. It's the one of just wanting to understand. It's the one of, well, I don't really understand it right now, but maybe I will in the future, and I'm okay with a little bit of suffering right now. We're probably familiar with the words of the Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu, where he says, watch your thoughts, they become your words. Watch your words, they become your actions. Watch your actions, they become your habits. Watch your habits, they become your character. Watch your character, it becomes your destiny. And sometimes, and I think it's helpful with the girls, is for all of us, I find this image quite helpful, that our brain is like a manufacturer. It manufactures our thoughts, and our mouth is like the customer who goes and purchases thoughts. So if our brain produces, you might say, negative thoughts or indifferent thoughts, or just not too pushed about kindness, or, you know, fear of taking the risk with kindness, whatever, fearful thoughts, negative thoughts, whatever types of thoughts, those thoughts are purchased by the customer, our mouth. But if the thoughts, the manufacturer is producing a thought that our mouth, stops buying, well, the manufacturer will stop producing them, will produce something else. So I suppose it's trying to help our teens to be more self-aware, you know, aware of their thought processes, whether it's to be complaining, or whether it's wanting to be right, or whether it's that fear, that emotion, to be aware. And then, because once we're aware of those thoughts, well, then we can decide on the thoughts that we give credence to, the ones that we accept, the ones that we embrace, the ones that we let influence our behaviors. And I think, and that gives our teens a sense of that they are in control of how they think, maybe not initially, but what they do with that thought, and how they can reframe how they perceive their reality. So what is our teen's brain manufacturing? What kind of thoughts? How does she speak about people? That says a lot about what she thinks about people, and what we think tends to influence what we believe about people. So helping them to challenge their thoughts, you know, I've often said the angel and the devil thing can be helpful sometimes, you know, and the angel's going, you know, well, why do you, I'm putting it in its place and not giving it full access, but just curious about the thought, challenging the thought, leaving it, parking it for a moment before dealing with it. Maya Angelou, I think she's pronounced her name, Oprah Winfrey's mentor, reminds us that if you don't like something, change it. If you can't change it, change your attitude, but don't complain. So kindness is not a feeling. It's one kind act followed by another, and that's what we call virtue. So when we think of this, you might say, virtue or this leadership quality, it's very helpful to think of some home truths. First of all, we need to fake it till we make it. You know, if we think, you know, typically often adults, I hear adults say, oh, I'm so impatient, we need to work at it. Well, that's perfect, because the things we need to work on are things that we don't have. So if we need to practice kindness because we often see we lack it, which is a very courageous and truthful space to be in, it shows a lot of maturity when our teens can actually practice that sense of self-awareness and self-truth. Leonardo da Vinci said, the greatest courage is to face yourself. So our teens need to develop that muscle You know, so they need to fake their virtues and try to show up. You know, they don't feel like being kind. Well, then they start noticing it and they go, okay, well, what, just practicing the skills. You know, I talked at the beginning about what's any leadership quality to do with. It's to do with a will and a skill. So they need to will it, to want it, desire it, and to build the muscle. So to show up, you know, so noticing, you know, when somebody needs kindness, somebody's stressed at school, somebody's quiet at school, somebody's just a little bit irritated. It's being able to go up, are you okay? Can I do anything for you? And to be okay if they get a rebuff. But that person will never forget the simple fact that they've actually been reached out to. That was a kind act in itself. We're not responsible for how people respond to us. We're only responsible for the circumstances. We're only our own personal, our own, how we deal with our own personal circumstances and our own response to it. Great for any of the girls who are into their sport, you know, you only get better with practice. Whether it's tennis, you're not born, you develop these qualities, these skills when we practice. So the same with leadership qualities, we only get better as we practice. Kindness isn't visible right away. You know, it's not like our phones or our devices. You know, we don't just swipe and it's there, unlike a photo. You know, it takes up to 20 days, studies show, of trying and failing. You know, failing is usually a sign that we're trying and we're conscious that we're failing. And day 21, then there's one success. And from that success comes the momentum and we build it up and it gets easier and our better lives crystallize. And any examples we have in our team's life that we can show them this, you know, look, remember you were struggling with maths, remember you were struggling with whatever it is, you know, your music, remember you were struggling with whatever it is that they have put effort into because they valued it in itself. I think is really, really helpful. We always need people to make us a kind and moral. In other words, we can't practice kindness on our own. Obviously, we can be kind to ourselves, but it's not the apex of the virtue. You cannot make a community out of nothing. And you might say there needs to be a virtue gym or a leadership gym or a spiritual gym for this. And human interactions is where we grow. Alistair MacIntyre, who's a famous Scottish philosopher, whose family hailed originally from Mayo. He has huge, 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 you might say, affection for the fishing villages around Killybegs because fishing, he feels, is like no other career because fishing communities are super, so dependent on each other. And he said that's what builds virtue, is that dependence, that codependence. When somebody's up, I you're down, I'm up. When I'm down, they're up. And that's the nature of it. Teens can front load things a lot, have very high expectations of themselves. So they want kindness, you know, almost like a Mother Teresa level, you know. Wanting something is not the same as having it. So we need to acquire it. And that's the big change in this generation. They're just not used to journeying with it. They're just not used to processes. And we almost need to hose them down a little bit, going, listen, you're human. It takes time. You're not going to learn this overnight. And they also have idealized versions of friendship, of human relationships. You know, they see their relationships that they should be perfect, that, you know, there should be lots of laughter, lots of cool vibes, lots of fun, but no arguing. Arguing is just, oh, it's not working. She doesn't like me. They jump to conclusions. And that's not real. There's far too much pressure on their friendships and it destroys them before they've even had a chance to start to grow. And it doesn't allow anybody to be human in their friendships because there's no allowance for mistakes. You might say it's almost like a tyrannical space. Our teens can be quite tyrannical, dictatorial with themselves first and their expectations of others. So it's really good that in all of this, we sort of call them out on that. True, real friendships and true, real and kindness in that context, because as I mentioned earlier, if there isn't a relationship, it's very hard to. That's where we practice kindness. That's where we will it and we develop skill for it. True, real human friendships are a decision to journey together. They're built through acts of goodness and kindness, not just having a laugh together. That's a really important conversation to have over and over again with your team, that friendships take work. Every relationship takes work. Our teens need to be robust enough to take the rough with the smooth in friendships and not to catastrophize things when things don't work out, you know, really, really important. So how we practice kindness is in our daily interactions with our friends, you know, fake it till you make it, you smile, Fake it till you make it. It means you when somebody's upset about something, when somebody you start noticing things, noticing people's basic needs, you know, if somebody's upset about something, knowing how to be with them in that situation, not being afraid of suffering the pain with them, not trying to move them on or fix them. And sometimes what can happen to our teens is when they see somebody suffering, they either try to fix them or else they just don't even go there. They just ignore it and hope it goes away. And either of those responses are a kind response. And that's where we really need to help our teens to go, no, you need to be there with people. That's what, you know, that's what friendship is about. Thinking of others before themselves, you know, that can be a very good thing and an easy thing to do in family situations, you know, when there's younger siblings, or ask so-and-so, or would you get her lunch while you're getting yours? Or no, we can't do that this weekend because so-and-so has this on, or can you call in on granny, or can you put out the bins for your mother? Or did you, you know, I want to watch this movie. Well, maybe we'll watch this one because so-and-so's, you know, a bit tired today. Or, you know, when there's competition about likes and dislikes, that's where we can have an opportunity to help our teens to practice kindness. Daily interactions, watching the language. I don't mean just bad language here, but also how our teens perceive things, you know, when they overreact to situations, you know, he's so mean, she's so whatever. I say, well, you know, how to help them to reframe that a little. How they serve, do they actively go out of their way to do things for others? You know, and we do need to accompany them in that. You know, it's your friend's birthday. Maybe it's not just about the consumerism of buying a present, but thinking of something meaningful. And I've seen teens do this time and time again. They can be so thoughtful and so kind and put a lot of work into these things for their friends. And it is lovely to draw that out in them. Role modeling kindness, you know, often older people are such a beautiful example of this, you know, because, you know, they've just learned to live for others their whole lives. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to help our teens to call that for what it is. If they're lucky enough to have an older, you know, to have a grandparent still alive or an older family member still alive, it's good as a parent or as a caring adult to be able to. So isn't that lovely how granny or granddad always seems to ask for so-and-so, or they always put themselves second? And that's because that's been a lifetime of caring. And isn't it lovely to be with somebody like that? It seems almost pedantic, but it is good to reflect on it, because it's those kind of interactions with older people that makes them such a joy to be around. I think as well, it's helpful to think about the fact that in our society, obviously mental fitness, I like to call it mental fitness as opposed to mental health, has been spotlighted. And one of the main things you might say with Arthur Brooks or with Simon Sinek or any of these big thought gurus who talk a lot about kindness and human relationships, they point out the difficulty with mental fitness or mental health is that one of the prime reasons for it is we don't know how to build deep and meaningful relationships. And you might say at the heart of deep and meaningful relationships is that ability to connect with people, no matter where they're at, whether I feel comfortable with it or whether I don't, whether I'm vulnerable here or whether I'm not, and the rough and the smooth. You're probably familiar with Simon Sinek, but he often makes the comment. He says, you know, when you walk into a bookshop, the shelves are full of self-help books, which are fantastic. But there's no section on help other books. I think it's a very interesting insight that we're seeking resources to help me. But one of the greatest resources to help me is to help others, because it gives me context on myself. It gives me a sense of being helping other, you know, it just gives me that sense of belonging, that sense of connection. It just has an extraordinary impact. When we actually serve others, the dopamine effect that it has actually physiologically, they say is extraordinary. And, you know, and at the same time, you know, he also makes the point is that we can have, because we're human, we can have conflicting emotions happening at the same time. And I think this is very helpful when we're talking to our teens about the kindness space, because we can be feeling lonely and we can also be feeling kind at the same time, choose to be kind. We can be fearful of suffering, but we can also choose to be kind. Just because I feel an emotion doesn't mean that dictates my behavior. We can feel lonely, but we can feel optimistic at the same time about a relationship. So emotions are normal. As we know, they're not dictators. They're just little signposts of something's going on. They tell us that we're human. We can't live without them. They're a very important part of our capacity to relate to others. But I think it's very helpful for us to know that it is hugely important that that for our teens, you know, if any of our teens are suffering, you know, with a particular mental health challenge at a moment or suffering from anxiety, one of the greatest antidotes of that is reaching out to others. And because you can often find in those situations where teens can be particularly sensitive. And that sensitivity is a beautiful thing to bring to bear in relationships with others. And I think as well, it's also very good for us to remind ourselves really of the space that our teens are in, which is actually different to the spaces that maybe you and I would have been in before, because of, you might say, the space of social media and all of those things that I've mentioned earlier, that we do need to spell the obvious, you know, walk through them and things, journey with them and help them, you might say, to be able to digest situations and regain perspective and situation that potentially they would have found very, very challenging. Just to mention a couple of things at the end, I suppose, the great resources that Maria has on this topic, with the girls. So I will put some of those resources actually at the end of this building leadership session. And obviously, as I mentioned, Love Your Enemies by Arthur Brooks, Road to Character by David Brooks also. Complainfully Free World by Will Bowen is also another one. And there's a wonderful book also by that young man I mentioned, Houston, who talks about the revolution of kindness, which is also very helpful. So anyway, it's 20 past eight. So I'll finish there. I hope that was helpful. And indeed, if there's any questions, be delighted to take any.